Welcome to Breaking the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. I'm your host, Sodaline Wang.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but are you suggesting that there's a significant number of Albertans who would welcome Donald Trump taking over Alberta?
Yes, there are.
Our guest today is Dr. Darren Dochuk, author of Anointed with Oil, How Christianity and Crude Made Modern America, published by Basic Books. He is a history professor at the University of Notre Dame. His research unearthed a long-standing fierce competition between what Dr. Dochuk calls the majors and the wildcatters.
Could you describe that difference and why you chose to center a lot of the conflict on these groups?
Sure. Well, as I dug into the longer history of oil, I had, you know, initially thought I'd start around 1900, the turn of the 20th century. But in fact, the story goes back right to oil's origins in Western Pennsylvania in the 1850s and 1860s. And what is remarkable about that story, and it's an aspect of early oil history that people might be a little more familiar with, and that is, of course, the ways in which oil initially created this major boom in Western Pennsylvania and drew thousands of oil small producers to the region, all, of course, hoping to drill and to strike it rich. That created a very chaotic landscape. This was wildcatting in action. Wildcatting, of course, being the function of testing new frontiers, taking high risks, applying, you know, whatever funds you might have to drill for that oil. But that created a very chaotic and really unsustainable landscape. And then along comes John D. Rockefeller, someone those students of history, of course, are more familiar with. He too is an independent oil man, at least initially, but he seeks quickly to kind of bring order to this landscape. In his mind, it's not about necessarily imposing his will, although it is that. It's about making oil more efficient, making the industry more efficient, cutting out the waste of over-drilling and so forth. What emerges then, of course, is the standard, the Rockefeller standard oil monopoly. Throughout the 1870s, he stamps out competition and takes control of the entire industry, so much so that by the 1890s, Standard Oil, headed by Rockefeller, is in control of over 90% of all oil refining in the country. So what happens to all the smaller oil producers that used to work this landscape? Now their livelihoods, their careers are being stamped out by Rockefeller. These independents, they move to the West and they bring with them the spirit of wildcat oil. That is a kind of a small producer ethic of high risk, high reward, drilling in frontier landscapes. And they bring that kind of heroic, kind of charismatic spirit of can-do spirit with them to the West. And there they, in fact, do strike it rich in Southern California around Los Angeles in the 1890s. And then eventually and most profoundly in Texas, starting especially with Spindletop on the Gulf Coast. So what this does is create essentially two competing sectors in the oil industry, the wildcatters, those small independent oil producers, and the majors based in the East, represented especially by Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Empire. And what became kind of curious to me, but also really important, is the way in which these two sectors didn't just compete in the oil industry itself, but also competed in the religious sphere. Both sides kind of representing different forms, especially of Protestantism, but of religion more generally. The wildcatters, the independents being, one could say, much more kind of evangelical, fervent in their evangelical Protestantism, very protective of their autonomy, both as businessmen and as local congregations. The majors, led by Rockefeller, being more ecumenical, liberal Protestant in their persuasions. And so throughout the 20th century, and this is something I really didn't anticipate when I started, much of the story of modern American religion, as well as the story of modern oil and politics, can be told through the lens of these competing sectors in the churchly corporate realms.
What do you mean by churchly corporate? You put those words together. What do you mean by that?
Good point. Well, it actually gets at the heart of what I'm trying to do in the book. Churchly in the sense of course, what's happening in the pulpits and pews of Protestant America. And of course, the story is of Christianity broadly. And so Catholics are in the narrative as well. But there's no doubt that the Protestantism of this story looms large. And in this churchly realm, in the realm of ecclesiastical politics, you're going to have splits between conservatives and liberals, between the fundamentalists and the modernists, as this battle becomes known in the early 20th century. And what I do in the book is to show how this struggle is actually also about the battle within the corporate sector of oil between the wildcatters and the majors. And this will ultimately play out in the political sphere as well. Throughout the 20th century, early 21st century.
You notice this, how do you call it, denominational difference between the more ecumenical Protestantism of the Rockefeller family and the Wildcatters, who, as you noted, more often tended to be Pentecostal or something like more evangelical, more of a charismatic style. You know, for the percentage of our audience that doesn't really understand those differences, could you illuminate that a little bit? Like you use the word premillennial a lot to just describe some of these wildcatters' religion. What do these things mean?
Mm-hmm. It's easy to get into the weeds here of kind of theological nuances between more conservative evangelical wings of Protestantism and more liberal ecumenical. What I hope to do in pairing oil, the story of oil with religion, was to show how even these nuances of end times thinking matter. Generally
Wait,
speaking,
what do you mean end times thinking?
Well, eschatology is a theology of end times. It is the ways in which Christians, Protestants especially, understand how the world is going to come to an end and what is waiting for them at the end. Certainly as we move into the 20th century, the dominant eschatology, and I don't want to, again, get too much into the weeds, but the dominant eschatology is one of optimism. It is post-millennialism, the sense that humanity, through collective brotherhood and labor, through the combined kind of workings of the church, regardless of denomination, can usher in the new millennium, can basically make the world better. This is the post-millennial eschatology that is very much operational in the kind of more liberal Protestant wing of the church that John D. Rockefeller and his son, Rockefeller Jr., kind of belong to. And they are in fact going to promote that kind of social gospel progressive action on behalf of the church, because it's optimistic, because it comes out of a place of confidence in their own role in American society, their dominance as well. Premillennialism comes into kind of the church and becomes more popular in the 20th century because it is a pessimistic eschatology. It's a crisis end times thinking. And that is, humans can't do anything to improve their world. All they can do is prepare for Christ's sudden, surprising second coming, right? The tribulation and the dark time spoken of in the New Testament, Revelation, is the gospel of premillennialism. Why does that matter? Because it kind of resonates with the position that wildcat oilmen find themselves in. It's a precarious business that they are in. They can lose everything quickly. They see their industry, they see the world through a dark lens, really. This is a fiercely independent gospel that believes all I can do to ready myself for the end times in my community is to commit to Jesus Christ, to convert, and simply wait for Christ to come. There are, again, implications to that that we could talk further, but the point here being is that they have two very different outlooks on modernity itself, two different outlooks on oil and what oil can do for modern America. So, yes, go ahead.
Well, so if I understand correctly, and you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, the post-millennialism of the Rockefeller types seems to be characterized by a taking on of responsibility of trying to expand in a way that encompasses the globe in a certain sense.
Yes.
In a sense that at least attempt to be constructive in a way that is that sees itself at least as a positive force.
Correct. Yes. No, well said. You know, this is in the 19th century, the United States is a Protestant nation. Yes, there are different religious communities. Catholics are very much present, Jews as well. But there's no questioning the authority that Protestantism has. And that spills over into kind of a post-millennial thinking that we can conceive of America as a Christian nation that can share the light, metaphorically, but literally, with the rest of the world. And so this is really the dominant force driving global missions by the American church in the late 19th, early 20th century.
And well, just to be clear, because we do have an international audience, when we're talking, when you're talking about America, you mean specifically the United States.
I should specify, yes, the United States.
Okay.
Of course, America is much broader than that. And
so, including your home of Canada, right?
Yes, Canada and to the south. Yes, for sure. So, you know, and I think a character here to focus on even more isn't John D. Rockefeller Sr., but his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., who becomes less important as an oilman in the early 20th century and becomes much more important as a philanthropist and as an ecumenical Christian who wants to use Standard Oil money to build up, again, an infrastructure of missionaries, of education, even medicine that can be spread globally, because this is the sense he has too, right? This post-millennial, that we can change the world for the better. And we can do so by, yes, spreading the gospel of the New Testament, but also by making the world better. And so Standard is going to look to China, for instance, as a way to build missionary agencies there and support them. They're going to look elsewhere throughout Asia and Europe as well. So one could say it's a social gospel, right? It's a social gospel of human brotherhood and partnership across denominational lines that is meant to focus on bettering this world. Whereas the premillennialists, the more conservative evangelicals, were otherworldly. They had very little patience, if any patience whatsoever, for the notion that humanity could be improved through collective social action. For them, the world was only going to get worse. And all that could be done was to save souls for Christ, to kind of evangelize, kind of let the forces of modernity play out without expectation of any improvement before the second coming of Christ.
Okay, so not to belabor the point, but according to the premillennial conception of the world, once Christ returns, what happens to all the non-Christians?
It's a pretty clear-cut scenario for premillennialists. Quite simply, those who have, you know, accepted Jesus as their personal savior, this is the formula of the New Testament gospel in their estimation, will ultimately be, you know, taken to heaven with Christ. There's debate in terms of the timing of at which this will happen. But it's a pretty clear cut. If you are a Christian, you are okay. If you are not, there is only one scenario. And of course, that is damnation. So it is a very, as I say, clear cut, black and white scenario. For more ecumenical progressive Protestants like Rockefeller, it was always a bit murky, right? There was sure an ideal of personal commitment to the gospel, but the uplift of humanity was a broader project that included education, science, medicine. There was still an optimism that even if someone did not necessarily pray the sinner's prayer, there was a potential for redemption ultimately, and more importantly, a redemption for society as a whole.
I'm curious about the role that the major oil industry at that time played in terms of quote-unquote opening up countries abroad outside the United States mm-hmm. to oil. I think especially notable is the attention you pay to missionaries and their roles in oil diplomacy. Could you talk mm-hmm. about that?
Sure. From the very beginning, as you know, I say in the book, American oil, United States oilmen, those associated especially with Standard Oil, were global in their vision. They wanted to reach a global market with their product, kerosene, but they also wanted to explore and open up new terrains for drilling and production and refining of oil. So this was a global initiative from the very beginning. And it's no surprise in that regard that missionaries would very early on come to assume a position of great import. Missionaries, as we know, were the forerunners of empire, of imperialism, whether it was British or American or what have you. They were usually the ones first on the ground in global terrains that could provide the information that oil hunters needed, that oil businesses needed to carve out new terrain. One of the key examples that I use in the book, and one of my more exciting finds, was I spent time in the British Petroleum Archives. And of course, British Petroleum was active in the early 20th century of opening up Persia and Mesopotamia to oil production. Of course, the legacy of that is Iran and Iraq. Where did they turn to initially to get the information they needed for their geologists to explore? Well, it was the missionaries, Protestant missionaries, both British and American, who were already active in this region. So from the beginning of this, of the oil kind of global crusade, was the import of missionaries as the vanguard. As we move through the 20th century, they will become important in other ways. And we can talk about Aramco, for instance, which becomes the most important global oil initiative in the mid-20th century, opens up Saudi Arabia to oil.
I think before we talk about Aramco, okay. I do want to talk about William Eddy.
Yes, sure.
I mean, this person seems to have a finger in multiple pots, but is he a missionary or he's mm-hmm. child of missionaries?
Mm-hmm. Yes, William Eddy is a fascinating character and really kind of gets at the heart of the ecumenical religious side of the equation of American or the United States' global kind of campaign to open up new fields. William Eddy was the son of missionaries in the Middle East, in Beirut, Lebanon, and throughout that region. And his parents were part of a generation of missionaries who came from the United States in the late 19th century to witness, you know, to share their Protestant faith in this region, which was, of course, intensely Muslim. Early on, Eddy's parents realized that simply sharing the good news of the gospel and winning converts to Christ was going to be very difficult in this land. And so what they did in concert with others in their generation was focus instead on just kind of spreading Christianity subtly through the construction of hospitals and through engineering and different educational training sites. This was the way you won over hearts and minds. It was through these less kind of confrontational or aggressive tactics. All that's to say is William Eddy grew up in a household that was very cosmopolitan in its outlook. Yes, it was, of course, planted in the Middle East to share the good news of Christianity, but it was also practical and engaged across religious secular lines. Eddy, as a result, grows up in this region, becomes multilingual. He's fluent. He knows Arabic. He knows Islam. And as American oil companies start to gain interest in the Middle East, it's no wonder that people like him become invaluable. They are the liaisons to the local culture. They are the liaisons to an entire region and a foreign faith as far as the American oil men are concerned. He becomes a key diplomat. There's the famous picture of him kind of brokering a deal between the United States and Saudi Arabia during World War II. He really is the pivotal figure in bringing American interests together with Arab interests in this region. And we kind of know the rest of the story, the post-World War II flourishing of oil production in Saudi Arabia and throughout the Persian Gulf.
We are interviewing Professor Darren Dochuk about Anointed with Oil, a parallel chronicle of petrol and what many call the American century. We'll return after a word from our sponsor. Welcome back to our interview with history professor Darren Dochuk as we continue talking about the apogee of the Arabists and the rise of the Arabian American Oil Company, Aramco.
In his course of negotiation with Saudi Arabia, he became tapped to work for Aramco.
Correct.
So Aramco is a very interesting beast, both internally and in terms of what it represented. Could you talk about that?
Yes. Well, William Eddy was what were labeled Arabists. He was part of a community of children of missionaries, of diplomats, again, who had grown up in that region and had a great deal of respect for the Muslim faith and for Arab culture broadly, including the language. And others of his generation would become absolutely crucial diplomats to setting the course for American involvement in the region through the early Cold War period, the 1950s and 1960s. And Aramco, as a conglomerate, a major corporation with mostly American interests in partnership with the Saudi Arabian government, of course, is going to be critical to the American Cold War kind of enterprise in that region. You'll recall that the British have been in this region much longer. British Petroleum itself was much more active early on in the 1900s. And so the United States' arrival on the scene in Saudi Arabia, also other Persian countries, Bahrain, for instance, is really significant. This marks a turn in global oil from the 1930s and 40s forward. William Eddy is on the scene. He's ready to again serve as a liaison between these different cultures, between corporate and government interests as well.
And so one of the peculiar things, though, I noted was how within Aramco he started a personnel organization or like the government relations organization in mm-hmm. Aramco. Mm-hmm. And this was a new thing, right? Like, I mean, he was critical to forming a group within Saudi Arabia itself. You know, so they were managing on the ground, not from the United States, but on the ground in Saudi Arabia. And they were bringing in workers from around the world. It's a very peculiar thing. I mean, it's a very new thing, isn't it?
It is. Aramco was highly experimental, one could say, in kind of a new technology of the modern corporation. It was structured in a way that involved many different departments. It was attuned to the unique kind of requirements of an international labor force. We do have workers coming to work for Saudi Arabia from all across the Persian Gulf region, from Pakistan and so forth. We also have kind of a mid-management of primarily American oil industry experts, many of them coming from Texas, from the Southwest, where there's already a well-established culture and educational kind of apparatus of oil. So you've got different ethnic, racial groups represented, different classes represented. This is a grand experiment in internationalism, and Aramco knows that. And so they are very deliberate in building up an entire kind of world onto itself that isn't just about drilling for oil. It's about creating communities. Aramco will build company towns in which we see housing for different tiers of workers, again, depending on where they're from. We have a sprawling kind of apparatus of labor relations, kind of the HR of its time. And within that, again, we have these Arabists who are, like Eddie, doing especially important work in information gathering, in basically explaining to Aramco how to deal with locals and with local culture. And that requires fluency in terms of language. It requires fluency in religion. It requires really, again, a cosmopolitan worldview. So often, you know, big oil, as it's called, is condemned for its imperial ambitions. And of course, there is no doubt about that. But what is also really enlightening and I think fascinating is the degree to which oil, as one of the first global industries, required of its major participants a cosmopolitan outlook that was very ecumenical in its religion and politics and in its appreciation of local cultures. So William Eddy represented that.
So how, for people who have been following politics related to September 11th and so on, isn't Saudi Arabia known for its rather strict, like theocratic, you know, a very like traditionalist Islamic faith? So how did Eddy and his cohorts construct this kind of ecumenical, I think Christian, right? Like mostly or entirely Christian community that like lived there? He wasn't flying in every weekend or whatever. Like these were people who actually had families, you know, had schools. They educated their children on the grounds in Saudi Arabia. So how did this happen?
Well, it's a great question. And I think obviously those like William Eddy, and he was surrounded by these Arabists who were working for the state or working in Aramco. You know, they were idealists and they were very, they had a romanticized view of American diplomacy in that region. They were so attached to the region that they were also, I think, blinded a little bit to the excesses of regimes, of empire, family empires in that region, including in Saudi Arabia. So they tended to look past or simply not dwell on the, of course, authoritarian, theocratic dimensions of oil, of Saudi Arabia and neighboring societies. You know, famously, of course, President Eisenhower defines America as a tri-faith country, right? American society is tri-faith. This is a country, a society that needs to embrace Protestants, Catholics, and Jews alike. These are the three pillars of American society. And of course, Eisenhower saw this as necessary to create this kind of civil ecumenical religion and American identity as a way to fight secular communism, atheistic communism, right? The Cold War fight required religious unity in American borders and beyond. And Eddie and his cohort of Arabists also wanted to see a fourth pillar added here, and they wanted Islam to be part of this, Muslims to be welcomed into America as well, right? So this, again, is a very idealistic and very forward-looking in many ways. What happens, and this is what explains the more recent kind of reality that you raised earlier, is of course the rise of Zionism. Israel becomes a more important American force in this region, all of which is disconcerting to Eddie and his partners in the Arabist camp. And then the War of 67 takes place, and this is what shatters their idealism. This is what shatters their hopes for a broader kind of coalition.
So let's backstep a little bit. The building of this cluster in, I think it's what, Dhahran? Within Aramco. I think part of what I was trying to allude to was that, sure, like Eddie and his fellows needed to, you know, overlook some of the more theocratic elements of the Saudi Arabian government, but the flip side of that was that the Saudi Arabian government needed to overlook the Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. of this cluster of people. It wasn't just Eddie, it was like entire families, like dozens of families, you know, imported from the United States, mm-hmm, from mm-hmm. you know, other parts of the world, including like India,
exactly, you know, yeah,
other regions of Middle Central Asia. How did the, you know, very devout, very, you know, fundamentalist, the mm-hmm. very straightforward Islamic government in Saudi Arabia at that time look towards this, you know, cluster of Christians in their midst? Mm-hmm. Like, how did that work?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and it's getting me it's forcing me to revisit some of the details of that area of the book, section of the book, and of my research, a section of the book that I really enjoyed writing, and because of these tensions that you highlight and the contradictions, really, that Eddie and his Arabist friends in general wanted to kind of glance over. So on one hand, they were promoting kind of an ecumenical partnership of faith in oil production and government in Saudi Arabia. This was a grand experiment in kind of ecumenism. But as you say, the flip side of it is that, of course, the Saudi Arabian government did not want any part of evangelical Protestantism or some of these other kind of Christian sects that were coming to Saudi Arabia via Aramco. Many of the workers coming from the United States were coming from Texas because they had experience in the oil industry. Well, again, as my book shows, it's no surprise that most of them were evangelical, right? They were fervent Protestants and they wanted to share their gospel. And the Saudi Arabia government, the royal family, of course, outlawed that altogether. And so you have a bit of a kind of a murky dance, if you will, in Aramco company settings where American families are wanting to practice their faith, even as managers like Eddie want to be diplomatic and pay respect to the kind of theocratic regime. All of this, again, creating tensions, as you suggest. So, but at least at the highest altitude, as far as Eddie was concerned, this was an experiment in ecumenical partnership with implications for business and governance that was worth pursuing. And for all its contradictions, it still was, for a short time at least, quite an amazing experiment at the ground level.
Well, and it wasn't just an experiment, though. I mean, it sort of succeeded. I mean, for a few decades at least.
So yes, it is not just an experiment, it is a success. Now, as other historians and scholars and critics have pointed out, you know, as you cut deeper, you see that there were, in fact, many failures and tensions playing out on the ground level as well, be it in the company town, be it on the drill sites, the racial undertones, you know, tensions between white Americans and workers from other areas of the Persian Gulf. There was plenty there to suggest that this wasn't the smoothest running operation either, that there was a crisis in the making. And that side of the equation, of course, the darker side is important to underscore because of what comes again in the late 60s and into the 1970s, when this, whether it's an experiment or great success, really does come undone, at least from the point of view of William Eddy.
Well, so I do want to note that it looks like Eddy was already dismayed when President Truman, right? Mm-hmm. Once the British approved the formation of the State of Israel, next to Jerusalem, which is like a major site for three different monotheistic religions. Uh-huh. Once the UK approves that, and then Truman quickly approves it as well, and Eddy becomes quite upset about that.
Yes, it's maybe a little difficult for us to look back on this moment from today and try to understand that, you know, today there's an assumption among Protestant Americans that Israel has a privileged status. And that is a function of the rise of evangelical Protestantism as a cultural force in America. Evangelicals were always Zionists as well. They always believed in the importance of Israel's statehood. And this goes back to their eschatology. Why is this functionally? Because Christ is going to return and has to return to Israel, right? So Israel always captures their imagination in this way. Now, but the,
wait, so I just want to clarify something. So when you say return to Israel, I think this is a point of theological importance, that when Israel is mentioned in the Bible, this was a book written, you know, like, I mean, in pieces, but written nevertheless about 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. long before any idea of Jewish nationalism or a state by and for Jewish people
right.
ever entered into people's minds. I mean, the idea of nation states didn't even exist 2,000 right. years ago.
Right. Of course. Right. So, yeah, you critique, of course, evangelical Protestant Zionism. And this is a creation of the late 19th, early 20th century. And there are blinders there, too. There is it's a very modern kind of narrow vision of what Israel means. For American evangelicals, it does mean statehood. It means not just a territory or terrain or a land. It is in their modern purview about nationalism itself, right? And so whatever import the Bible might have placed on you know, the Jewish people for evangelicals becomes attached to nationalism itself. And this is the combination that will become quite potent in modern American politics to today. There's no questioning, of course, among many evangelical Protestants of the blessedness of Israel and the divine favor that Israel and the United States together possess, right? So, and that really comes into the American imagination in the 40s forward, 1940s forward. So at that very moment, though, you've got a large segment of liberal Protestants, those who are more ecumenical, who are dismayed at the founding of Israel because it is going to upset really what they see as the essentials of the Middle East, and that is the primacy of kind of local Arab cultures that have long possessed this land. Eddy is a champion of the Palestinians, right? He does not want them to be displaced. And one could say that there is a certain elitism and almost anti, not almost, but a form of anti-Semitism among Eddy and his elite Protestant kind of group, right? These are Ivy Leaguers. The Ivy League itself, you know, was anti-Semitic into the 1930s, 40s with quotas as to how many Jewish students were allowed and so forth. So Eddy represented that. And this is why he was so animated against the founding of Israel and became dismayed at American, by the 60s, Johnson and Kennedy's decision to kind of raise the priority of Israel as America's, as the United States' partner, rather than surrounding Arab countries.
You do note this in the book. I'm curious. So I think one of the things that animated the, as you say, pre-millennial evangelical movement regarding Israel was this assumption that there would be lots of oil there. And then for quite a long period, and even I think to today, there's still no large cache of oil
right
where Israel is.
Right.
So how do the evangelicals in the United States square that with themselves?
Yeah, no, it's one of those areas, again, that I really was surprised by. So you have these major oil companies, different wings of kind of the Standard Empire. You've got British and French companies, all active in the Middle East. And again, with the help of William Eddy and others, of this is a major undertaking and partnership between state and corporation and so forth. Wildcatters, the independent oilmen that I highlighted, again, are always more focused on domestic production on American soil because they can't afford to go international, right? They're generally maybe mid-majors in their capacity to produce and refine and market globally, but they can't compete with these large major companies, with one exception, and that has to do with Israel. So when Israel is founded, of course, it strikes the imagination, especially of evangelicals in the Southwest, Texas, Oklahoma, because of their religious and theological and eschatological beliefs in the importance of Israel. But it also strikes them as potentially fruitful for their oil exploits. Here is a country that they can work in as well, right? They can work in independently. And so they forge ties with Israel. Israel, of course, is absolutely desperate to be energy independent. So it's hunting for oil in the 50s and 60s, just hoping that it can be secure from the Arab oil producing countries that surround it. And these evangelical independent oilmen are going to happily oblige. They're going to go to Israel and drill, drill, drill. But as you say, they're not going to find anything. And even today, though, there are still American oil companies active there. Many of these, led by evangelicals, are reading the New Testament. They're reading the what they think are the signs of oil being present in Israel and trying to kind of hunt it down and chase it. To no avail. We know, again, the rest of the story is that oil will never be found in substantial quantities. It is found offshore, and there have been some successes. But all of this, I think, to your point, I imagine, is to show just how the importance of American-Israel relations to evangelicals in the United States isn't just about theology. It's not just about politics. It's also very much about oil and their commitment to this resource.
Now we're going to pick back up. So you were saying the 1967 war that I think is also known as the Six-Day War?
Correct.
And a lot of people are not familiar, Israel, you know, Egypt. Like, could you talk us through a little bit of how the Six-Day War started and the result for the oil industry and for relationships, you know, between these various countries after?
You know, by 1967, Israel has built a pretty impressive military and is anxious to protect its borders, but also to gain control of some of these surrounding territories, the most important, Sinai Peninsula, which is for a time kind of overseen or governed by UN peacekeeping forces. The UN will withdraw those. So the UN peacekeepers withdraw from the Sinai, and this leaves this region vulnerable to competing interests between Israel and Egypt. Israel, sensing again the aggression, or at least anticipated aggression of Egypt and its neighbors, its Arab neighbors, carries out a preemptive strike, really, in June of 1967, launches a surprise attack that really takes out a good deal of the Egyptian Air Force, will also be followed with strikes on nearby Syria and Jordan as well. The aftermath, the result of this is Israel has established itself as a powerful military country, willing to fight and able to fight now with the most advanced technology. This you know, awaken Egypt and Syria to this new power amidst in the Middle East. Why is this important? Well, it changes the equation. Certainly, Israel is now the assertive power in the region with the help of the United States. In response, of course, countries like Egypt, but also Saudi Arabia, Arab nation states in the region are going to become much more anti-Western in their sensibilities. They're going to be opposed to those Western forces that are supporting Israel. And this is most importantly, the United States. So in the wake of that, you're going to have Aramco purging its payroll of Americans. Americans are going to have to leave the country quickly. Families packing up and leaving Aramco immediately. So this changes the equation. And what was once a partnership between American and Saudi interests is going to become primarily one now of Saudi interests. And over the course of the 1970s, Saudi Arabia will take control of Aramco and become the sole kind of authority over the company by the 1980s.
How does this play out in terms of America's neighbor? Like, you notice, you note that Alberta, the mm-hmm. province of Alberta in Canada, is also a major oil producing center. Like, and part of that was through investment by, was it the Pew family or specifically, or what was that?
And yeah, and the Pew. Mm-hmm.
And what's the international picture in terms of U.S. oil and Canadian oil, and how do the politics intersect?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've emphasized, you know, in this conversation and in the book, I mean, independent wildcat oilmen have always focused on domestic reserves. This is why today they are backing the Trump administration's designs to deregulate what were highly regulated environmental terrains in the West and Alaska and so forth. They want to drill. They have to. They need domestic reserves. The one exception was Canada, which of course has proximity and is essentially still part of the same terrain. You know, in media post-World War II period, as major oil was looking abroad to the Middle East, independent oilmen like J. Howard Pugh and his family's run company, which is Sunoco or Sun Oil Company, based in Pennsylvania, they started looking to Canada as an alternative. You know, if we want to shore up American interests against, you know, the Cold War red menace of the Soviet Union, they saw Canada, Western Canada in particular, as part of the same endeavor. And so Pugh starts the Athabasca Oil Sands project in Alberta. Albertans, always more conservative than the rest of Canada. They are very evangelical. They are kind of like, again, Texas, the Texas of the North, are welcoming of these incursions. And as a result, what you see is Alberta begins to associate and identify on a north-south axis with Texas, Oklahoma, and the Southwest because of these shared oil interests. It's no accident that if we look at today, current politics, there is a secessionist movement in Alberta to try to leave Canada and connect with the United States. And it's because of the shared interest in oil, the shared religious and conservative political culture of this place, which is more closely aligned with Texas than it would be with Ontario or Quebec or other provinces in Canada.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but are you suggesting that there's a significant number of Albertans who would welcome Donald Trump taking over Alberta?
Yes, there is. I don't think it's going to make any serious inroads, but there is currently a secessionist movement, and there is going to be a referendum, the last time I checked, on whether Alberta should leave the union. Now, that's not going to pass. It's still a minority voice in Alberta, but it's an important large voice, a large presence of pro-American, pro-conservative Albertans who see their battle against the liberal elite as Trump's followers in the United States would see theirs as a battle against the liberal elite in Washington and so forth.
So then, you know that also in the late 60s and into the 70s, something interesting happens within the evangelical Christian movement in the United States. This is the rise of figures like Jerry Falwell. And how is he tied into the story of oil? Yeah, how is this political arm of premillennial Christianity coming into the fore?
Well, you know.
And why?
Right. The 1970s becomes this pivot point in American politics and in the relationship of religion and politics. And there's many reasons why we could point to this decade for being so crucial to shifting trajectories. One way historians have talked about the rise of Jerry Falwell and conservative evangelicalism as a political force is to look at the culture wars of the 70s that emerged. Battles over Roe v. Wade and abortion rights, reproduction rights, battles between kind of progressive liberals and conservatives over the Equal Rights Amendment and feminism. There's a way in which, again, changing social norms are creating these battles between progressives and conservatives. My book shows that oil is also part of the equation for a few different reasons. I mean, where is the new kind of stronghold of American evangelicalism by the 70s? It's the South. It's Texas. It's Oklahoma. It's Georgia and across the southern rim of the country. This is oil patch America. This is where the long-standing influence of wildcat Christianity, as I say, the independence of the oil industry have taken root and have been able to create their own empires. And they're using oil monies to support their religious causes, their Christian megachurches, evangelical megachurches. And they have increasingly come to build a political apparatus of conservatism that can influence first the Republican Party and then ultimately shift the course of the country to the right. And so the 70s is that moment, that flashpoint where this comes now to the forefront. And so as much as we want to look at the rise of the religious right in the 70s as the product of cultural wars over social issues, it's also about energy. It's also about oil. And it's also about these competing visions of American exceptionalism in the world, right? I'll just add to that, you know, thinking again about the world of oil in the 70s, after the 1967 Six-Day War, you have the war Yom Kippur in 1973 when Israel's Arab oil-rich countries attack it in retribution for 1967. And you've got the rise of OPEC and Arab oil-producing countries band together to create an incredibly powerful lobby and essentially take control of global oil reserves. And this puts the United States, for the first time, in a vulnerable position. The energy crisis, of course, hits the United States in two waves. Economic decline, deindustrialization. The 70s is going to undergo and witness profound changes to political economy. All of this, again, is playing out in a way that allows an evangelical wildcat kind of coalition of Southerners to take control of the Republican Party. And again, one could say we know the rest of the story. Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980. And from then on, we see a very powerful coalition in American religion and politics that is basically defining American politics today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dolchak. I appreciated your insight into this very multifaceted topic that influences huge swaths of recent, but also decades long, U.S. domestic and foreign policy.
Well, thank you, Sotalin, for the opportunity. And I must say, you read deeply, and the questions were just outstanding. And it is a sweeping book, and I hope that there are pieces that resonate especially with readers.
You've just heard our interview with Dr. Darren Dochuk about his book, Anointed with Oil, published by Basic Books. Digging the Bones is an independent podcast free from the influence of Fortune 500 companies, governments, and political parties. You can find more episodes of this podcast on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi, or look for us on iTunes and iHeartRadio. Thanks this week to Dorothy Wolters for use of the audio track Zwischen den Zeiten. I think that's how it's pronounced. I'm your host, Sotalin Wang, signing off.